You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening, Shavuot Tov. Purim Sameach. It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Saturday, March the 23rd, 2024. This is Nomi Segal with a news roundup. It's been cleared for publication that Sergeant Major Eli David Garfinkel, aged 21, of Sitria, a fighter in the elite Duvdivan unit, was killed in exchanges of fire with the terrorist who carried out a shooting attack yesterday near Dolev in Binyamin. In the battle, an IDF officer and soldier were seriously wounded, and five other soldiers sustained light to moderate injuries. Their families have been notified. The terrorist was neutralized. Israeli security forces overnight mapped out the terrorist's home in the Ramallah area in preparation for its demolition. In the northern Gaza Strip yesterday, a reserve IDF officer was seriously wounded. Since the start of the war, 595 IDF soldiers have fallen. In the north, the IDF struck several military positions and an observation post of Hezbollah in locations along the Lebanon border with Israel. Over the course of the day, a number of launches from Lebanon were identified toward Hardov, Margaliot, and Shomura. Two Hezbollah drones that infiltrated Israel earlier today exploded near Kfar Blum. There were no injuries. The Iron Dome also intercepted two rockets fired from Lebanon. In the Gaza Strip, IDF and Shin Bet forces continue to operate in Shifa Hospital. The head of the IDF Southern Command, Major General Yaron Finkelman, said the IDF will continue the operation, will conclude the operation, only when the last of the terrorists is in our hands, alive or dead. He held a situation assessment yesterday at the hospital with the head of IDF intelligence, Major General Aaron Khalifa, and other senior officers. Finkelman said that in the course of the operation, hundreds of terrorists have been hit, hundreds have been arrested, and the IDF has secured significant operational and intelligence assets. The IDF spokesperson said that throughout the mission, Israeli forces have taken steps to avoid harm to civilians, patients, medical staff, and equipment. The IDF spokesman has categorically denied Palestinian claims that several Palestinians were killed by IDF fire while waiting for humanitarian aid east of Gaza City today. The spokesman said that the army allowed an aid convoy to enter the northern part of the strip. When it approached the distribution point, hundreds of Palestinian civilians waiting for the aid blocked it and began looting it. The IDF spokesman said there were no airstrikes on the convoy, and it was not aware of any IDF fire toward the convoy. The IDF is continuing to check the reports. Meanwhile, security sources are said to believe that the Hamas Gaza leader, Yahya Sinwar, is hiding in the Khan Yunis area and other leaders elsewhere in the strip. It is believed that Hamas knows the locations of only 40 of the 134 hostages in Gaza, which is why that is the number Israel is demanding be released in the first stage of any potential hostage release and ceasefire deal. A Khan reporter says that defense establishment sources hope that questioning of Islamic Jihad and Hamas senior figures captured in the Shifa Hospital raid can provide additional information on the captives. The contacts on a hostage release deal and ceasefire are continuing in Doha, Qatar. Israel's foreign minister, Yisrael Katz, lashed out at the United Nations chief, Antonio Guterres, today, saying that under his leadership, the world body has become an anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli organization that shelters and bolsters terror. Katz was responding to remarks the UN chief made on the Egyptian side of the Rafah crossing today. Katz wrote on the social media platform X that Guterres blamed Israel for the humanitarian situation in Gaza without condemning in any way the Hamas ISIS terrorists who plunder humanitarian aid, without condemning UNRWA that cooperates with terrorists, and without calling for the immediate, unconditional release of all Israeli hostages. Guterres, during the visit, said that he came to the crossing to raise awareness of the pain of the Palestinians. He called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. He also said there is international consensus that any ground assault on Rafah would cause a humanitarian catastrophe. Here is an excerpt from his remarks.
I say again, nothing justifies the horrific attacks by Hamas on October the 7th. And nothing justifies the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. Now more than ever, it is time for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. It is time to silence the guns. Palestinians in Gaza, children, women, men, remain stuck in a non-stop nightmare. Here from this crossing, we see the heartbreak and heartlessness of it all. A long line of blocked red relief trucks on one side of the gates, the long shadow of starvation on the other. That is more than tragic. It is a moral outrage. Any further onslaught will make things even worse. Worse for Palestinian civilians. Worse for the hostages. And worse for all people of the region.
UN Chief Antonio Guterres. The UN Security Council is set to vote on Monday on a resolution demanding a ceasefire in Gaza during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, but the United States has warned the measure could hurt negotiations to pause the Israel-Hamas war and is unlikely to back it. The resolution put forward by the 10 elected council members is backed by Russia and China, who yesterday vetoed a U.S.-sponsored resolution that supported an immediate and sustained ceasefire in the Gaza fighting. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, after meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken yesterday, doubled down on the message he has expressed in recent days that while Israel will happily work with the U.S. on improving the humanitarian situation and evacuating civilians from Rafah, a military operation there is inevitable. Blinken, for his part, stressed yesterday that a major ground offensive in Rafah was not the way to defeat Hamas, and he warned that it would risk more civilian fatalities, undermine aid assistance, risk greater isolation for Israel, and endanger Israel's security and international standing. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant is slated to travel to Washington tomorrow for talks at the invitation of his U.S. counterpart. Abroad briefly, the Islamic State group has officially claimed responsibility for last night's terror attack in Moscow and published photos of the terrorist. The statement said that four of its members attacked the concert hall armed with knives, machine guns, and incendiary bombs. According to reports from Russia, more than 140 people were murdered in the attack and 100 others wounded. Russian authorities said 11 suspects have been arrested. Israel's President Isaac Herzog issued a statement on the social media platform X condemning the attack. The weather outlook. No significant change tomorrow. Chance of local rain accompanied by isolated thunderstorms mostly in the south and east. The maximum temperatures in the main centers, Jerusalem 14, Tel Aviv 19, Haifa 16, Beersheba 18, and in Eilat going up to 22 degrees Celsius. That's the news. Our sound engineer this evening is David Miran. This is Nomi Segal. Now over to our pre-recorded weekly news magazine.
You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening and Shavua Tov. This is Nomi Segal with a look at some of the stories we covered this week. The IDF launched a military operation in the Shifa Hospital in Gaza, returning to the facility after intelligence indicated that Hamas terrorists had regrouped there. The IDF spokesperson, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, in a briefing from the site of the hospital earlier this week, gave a situation update and spoke about the aim of the operation.
We are here at Shifa Hospital. This is the entrance to the hospital. This is the Qatari building. This is the emergency room. In this compound, many Hamas terrorist operatives and senior ones have been hiding in the hospital. And also Islamic Jihad group has been hiding in this hospital. When we entered the hospital, we were finding terrorists fighting against us here in this area. Until now, we have arrested over 250 Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists that we identified. We are still conducting an investigation on over another 350 people that we suspect that they are also connected to terror. Until now, none, civilians, doctors, medic teams, none have been hurt. Only the terrorists. We are supplying food, water. We have supplied yesterday two generators to the emergency room because there was a problem with electricity. We are supplying also technicians to fix the problems inside the emergency room and the generators. We are also supplying medic teams to assist with everything or anything that is needed. We found in the compound over 11 million shekels used by Hamas, giving the money to his operatives to conduct terror from the northern Gaza. Hamas have tried to control again Shifa Hospital as a hub to conduct all its terror mission in northern Gaza. We call Hamas terrorists to surrender. We call it and we speak by Arabic speakers here on the ground, but they are still hiding in this building, in the emergency room, exploiting and using the patients and the medic teams. This is Hamas, and we will reach every terrorist in this compound until we finish the mission.
IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari. U.S. concerns over a broad Israeli military operation in Rafah with high civilian casualties raised tensions between the Biden administration and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, with the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer directly criticizing the Prime Minister's policies and calling for elections in Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu pushed back and also spoke with U.S. President Joe Biden, during which the leaders agreed that an Israeli team would meet with administration officials in Washington to discuss alternatives to a broad operation there. Former Israeli ambassador to Washington, Dani Ayalon, in a briefing to the Jerusalem Press Club, spoke about the shifting dynamic and what is behind it.
It's unfortunate because Israel and the United States are natural allies, not only because of the shared values and the ethos and the history in the last few decades, but also a strong Israel is a national security Israel, a national security interest of the United States in the region. A strong Israel deters attacks, wars, stability is more common. And, of course, there is another reason where only a strong Israel will be able or acquiesce to have to make some concessions politically. This was the case with peace with Egypt and Jordan, and the next one should be with the Palestinians at some point. So it is very difficult to see the deterioration of the relations between Netanyahu and his government and the American administration, to the effect that there is not much trust or appreciation, and we can discuss this later why. But since the United States is very much interested in Israel's well-being and security, and at the same time, they do not care for the Netanyahu policies and even his personal behavior, they had no choice but to distinguish between this government and the country and the state, the people of Israel. That means that they continue to support Israel and to back it up, especially in when it comes to the supply of munitions and arms and weapons. But at the same time, a lot of criticism vis-a-vis Netanyahu, to the extent that some high-level American officials ask or pray for his resignation and for having new elections here in Israel. I mean, this is really unprecedented, this distinction between people and government has always been reserved to dictatorships, to governments which are not legitimate. Now, the case of Israel is different because whether we like it or not, and the government of Netanyahu was democratically elected, and it's legitimate, and so we have to bite the bullet, and whoever is hopeful for a political change in Israel, the only way to do it is through elections. The only way to bring elections forward is to have a non-confidence vote in the Knesset, or to have the government voluntarily, the prime minister, resign. At this point, I don't see that any of these options are available or feasible. So it will be very important for both the United States and Israel to start and I would say restart the relationship.
Regarding those relations, I think the separation between the Israeli people and the government is perhaps very true about politicians like Biden or the old school politicians. Is it still true of the Democratic Party? Surveys are showing that the new generation is drifting away towards Israel. That's going to be reflected in the politicians as well. So what can we see in the future?
Yes, well, we do see that actually Israel has become a partisan issue, which has never been before. Israel always enjoyed the bipartisan support. But I would say that starting with the Obama years and the Obama-Netanyahu relationship actually brought about this partisanship, where the perception is that the Republicans are pro-Israel and the Democrats are anti-Israel, which is not the case. Actually, if you look and break down the different segments of the Democratic Party, you will still see that the mainstream is very supportive of Israel, and you can see it in many of the public opinion polls and surveys. However, there is deterioration with the regards to Israel when it comes to younger generation, and certainly with the progressive liberal elements of the Democrats. And here, I believe that the government of Israel was lax in not addressing these issues, because there is a lot that can be done to bring back the bipartisanship support of the United States, because, as I said, U.S. and Israel are natural allies, and all the rift that we see now between the government of Israel and the administration is something that is totally unnecessary.
Do you have any suggestions on how Israel can improve its ties with the United States?
Oh, absolutely. To initiate, to be more innovative on the diplomacy and the political issues. See, we have had a brilliant military campaign. And I say that because I don't think any other military would have had a better achievements with, unfortunately, we have this what we call collateral damage. We have, the death of many uninvolved. But if you compare the war in Gaza to any other wars in recent time, the ratios between uninvolved and terrorists is the minimal in this case of Gaza. If you compare it to what happened in Afghanistan or Iraq, Mosul, Fallujah. But this is not enough. Because in order to, establish and cement a military success or victory, you must end it with a political arm or with the political doing. And here, Israel has lacked on that. Unfortunately, we did not initiate. So we were always following pressure and demands from the international community or from the United States. Look at this humanitarian aid, I believe that if Israel had initiated the humanitarian aid from the start, we would have established much better rapport and relations between Netanyahu and Biden. And also, we could have, I would say, leveraged this to get more understanding to Israel's security needs. For instance, the entering into Rafah. It's imperative if he wants to have a full victory over Hamas. And I think everybody should understand that Hamas should not be able to govern again Gaza or any other territory. And the only way to make sure that Hamas would not be a viable entity militarily, even politically, is that we have to close up its gateway to the outer world, to the Sinai, to Egypt, and that is Rafah. And I believe here again, we could have explained it better, and we could have gotten better goodwill by doing more on the humanitarian to start with. Things that we are doing anyway, so why not get something for it? Another issue is that the Americans expect, for many reasons, to show plans and visions from the government of Israel. First of all, a plan about the day after in Gaza, who's going to be in control. Now here, I think there is quite an understanding that the security control should be for the foreseeable future by the IDF. However, civil control, I think, should be by Palestinians. The Americans talk about the Palestinian Authority or revitalized Palestinian Authority. And this is something that there is a lot of room to discuss and break it down, what can be done. So here I think Israel was lax in actually negotiating or talking or consulting with the Americans about the day after. At this point, just to say no is not a policy. Secondly, is about the vision of the region. And here the Americans would like to see normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Arab world in order to stabilize the region, in order to bring about prosperity, and very importantly, to isolate Iran and its proxies. And here again, Israel does not show any inclination of discussing that future as well. This is what I think is imperative if we want to really change the dynamic of the relations between Israel and the international community, especially the United States.
Former Israeli ambassador to Washington, Dani Ayalon. Here's Hanan Ben-Ari, Ata Lo Levad. You are not alone.
Yamim shel matechet והלב נסגר חיוך כמו כספת אתה ממוחזר עוד מיתר נקרע בגיטרה לב בוכה קרבה לקום וללכת נשרף לו עוד יום השמש בורחת מתוך תהום תראה אותה זורחת בסוף הלילה השתקף מולך במים ברבור לבן נשרף לו עוד יום נשרף גם הפחד מתוך תהום תראה אותה זורחת תגיד לי מה אתה רואה עכשיו במים אתה לא לבד אף פעם לא לבד תמונה מתקלפת והזיכרון לבד על מרפסת מול מכתש המון רק שלא תיפול שוב לחושך המתוק המנותק עונה מתחלפת נשרף עוד יום השמש בורחת מתוך תהום אותי לא תזורחת בסוף הלילה השתקף מולך במים ברבור לבן נשלף לו עוד יום נשלף גם הפחד מתוך תהום אותי לא תזורחת תגיד לי מה אתה רואה עכשיו במים אתה לא לבד אף פעם לא לבד
לא לבד
אף פעם לא לבד מתחלפת ושוב
Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz visited Israel this week, expressing support for Israel, but also concern for the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. Prime Minister Netanyahu stressed Israel's efforts to address the humanitarian situation in Gaza, while underscoring that Hamas must be eliminated. Here is an excerpt from their remarks.
We've just had, I think, a very serious conversation, an important conversation among friends. You expressed your concerns for two things. One, protecting civilians, and second, provision of humanitarian aid. And I explained that these are our concerns as well, because we agree with both goals. In fact, the Army of Israel has done more to minimize civilian casualties than any other army in modern times, and certainly any other army faced with just with such dense urban warfare and an enemy that seeks to use civilians as human shields, as Hamas does, often at gunpoint. Secondly, we are doing unusual efforts to increase humanitarian aid by land, by sea, by air. The main problem that we see is the distribution of this aid once it gets into Gaza and the fact that it is being looted by Hamas and by others. This is something that we have to have a joint effort to try to prevent it. The responsibility for this disruption and for the civilian casualties should be laid at Hamas's door. Israel will do whatever it can to minimize that those casualties and maximize humanitarian aid as needed. We also agreed that Hamas has to be eliminated. We cannot have a future for Gaza, a future for peace, a future for Israel, if Hamas, a terrorist organization committed to our genocide, remains intact. If it remains intact, it will regroup and reconquer the Gaza Strip and, as they vowed, repeat the massacre again and again and again. We cannot have peace if Hamas is there. Hamas has to be eliminated for any possibility of peace and progress. When we talked briefly also about the day after Hamas, the one thing that I would stress is it's got to be the day after Hamas is eliminated. That will open up other possibilities, but none can be realized unless Hamas is eliminated.
Prime Minister, many thanks for receiving me today. We have been on the phone quite a lot in the last weeks and months, but nothing can replace a meeting in person. 160 days. 160 days that still more than 100 Israeli citizens are in the hands of Hamas. 160 days of suffering for them, an unbearable incertitude for their families and friends. They are in our thoughts and prayers, just as the memory of the more than 1,200 who were brutally murdered on October 7th. We will not forget them. Blessed be their memory. In these dark hours, my country stands by the people of Israel. From day one, our message has been clear. Israel has the right to defend itself against the terror of Hamas, and all hostages must be released. This cruel crime must end now. Israel's military operation in the Gaza Strip has now been going for about 5 months, and large parts of Hamas' military infrastructure have been destroyed. During these 5 months, the cost in human lives and the number of civilian casualties has grown to be extremely high. Many would argue much too high. As a partner and as a friend of Israel, I have shared my concerns about the development of this war with the Prime Minister. By fighting Hamas terrorists, Israel is pursuing a legitimate goal. Never again end October 7. The longer the war lasts, the higher the number of civilian casualties rises, the more desperate the situation of the people in Gaza become, the more this begs the question, no matter how important the goal, can it justify such terribly high costs? Or are there other ways to achieve your goal? Take the ground offensive in Rafah. The military logic is one consideration, but there is a humanitarian logic as well. How should more than 1.5 million people be protected? Where should they go? I also spoke to the Prime Minister today about the need to provide the people in Gaza with comprehensive humanitarian aid supplies. We cannot stand by and watch Palestinians risk starvation. That's not us. That is not what we stand for together. Much more humanitarian aid is needed continuously, reliably. I shared my concerns with the Prime Minister that provision of aid from Israel into Gaza and the conditions for distribution must be urgently and massively improved. And finally, we need a hostage deal with a longer-lasting ceasefire. I know how difficult it is to reach an agreement with the Hamas terrorists, but we understand the hostage families who say after more than 5 months, the time has come for a comprehensive hostage government of Qatar as well as Egypt. They have our full support. What also remains important from my view, Hezbollah must withdraw from the border area north of Israel. We are working on this on the basis of Security Council Resolution 1001 with the United States and many others.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Meanwhile, Israel criticized Canada over its announcement this week of an embargo of future arms sales to Israel amid domestic pressure in Canada over the Gaza war. Alan Baker, a former Israeli ambassador to Canada and former legal advisor to the foreign ministry, spoke to reporter Arie O'Sullivan about the decision. Baker, who is currently director of international law at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, said Canada's arms sales to Israel are minimal.
10 years ago, the former Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, was here in Israel, and he declared in the Knesset that Canada has got Israel's back in fire and water. Canada will be behind Israel. So there has been a considerable change over the last 10 years. They say it's because of a huge amount of immigration from Muslim countries. But also the trend that's going on now, the trend of anti-Semitism, the hostility to Israel, the reliance on propaganda that's not really accurate propaganda, but it nevertheless is catching on. And all these things together brought about a consensus in Canada. Well, you know, one of the surprising things is that the Canadian Jewish community is mostly supportive of the Liberal Party, which is the ruling party. They finance it and they support it. Irving Kotler, for instance, is a leading member of that party. So it's quite surprising that the present Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has allowed himself to go along with this and has actually taken the majority of the Liberal Party with him by making various small changes in the motion that was proposed. But it's nevertheless a motion that's, in my view, violently hostile to Israel, and a great shame. The motion was proposed by the New Democratic Party, mm-hmm. which is a left-wing party which was established in the 1950s by Jewish intellectuals.
Wow.
So we can see that over the years, Canada has evolved, has changed. As I said, a mass influx of Muslim immigrants. And Jewish community, for some strange reason, doesn't seem to be able to influence this. There's a representative organization, the CIGA, which is supposed to be a lobbying organization, but I don't see that they've done anything here.
Well, Ambassador, let me ask you, I mean, is this a mainly symbolic movement, motion? I mean, does Israel really buy weapons from Canada?
Oh, no, I think what Israel imports and things like that. It's from that point of view, it's not a serious boycott of Israeli weaponry. It's symbolic, but there are also other elements in there. For instance, they're supporting the South African case in the International Court of Justice. They're adopting the false propaganda put out by Hamas with respect to 30,000 people killed, mostly women and children, etc. In other words, they're just accepting this lock, stock and barrel, and this is a party that's been always supportive of Israel.
Well, diplomatically, this is a blow to Israel to have Canada take the stand.
Sure, but if you look at it logically, Canada will always do what Europe does. They consider themselves apart from the United States, and whatever the United States does, they try and do something else. And their tendency is to go together with Europe, especially France, because you've also got Quebec and the French-speaking Canadians. And so that's their tendency. And if Europe is going in that direction, then regrettably, Canada is going in that direction, despite the fact that the Jewish community has always been quite effective in the Liberal Party of Canada.
So I guess some people would say, all right, so Canada made this symbolic decision. It doesn't really sell much arms to Israel. So what? So
exactly. Fine. That's what I said. So, look, it was sad knowing the Jewish history in Canada. And, you know, during the Second World War, there was a stage when they wouldn't allow any Jews to come into Canada. One of the Canadian politicians said, one is too many.
Wow.
So they've come a long way, and the Jewish community is an influential and wealthy community in Canada. But unfortunately, there are other elements now in Canada that have greater pressure and influencing especially a weak prime minister.
Alan Baker, former Israeli ambassador to Canada. Here's Bet HaBubot, Sigafu.
גל של הזיות בטבע מאבד מציאות לרגע איך בסוף היא תמיד חוזרת לעצמה ולא די לה פתאום שנדמה שהשחר לא יפציע לעולם עוד עולה זיכרון ישן פתאום שנדמה שחר לא יפציע לעולם עוד עולה ומראה לאן סיגפו זה חם וזה פוגע
לא את הכל אתה יודע. זה אותו האור שתמיד ליווה אותך ולא די. פתאום שנדמה שהשחר לא יפציע לעולם, עוד עולה הסיתרון ישר. פתאום שנדמה שהשחר לא יפציע לעולם, שם כדי להשליך לה את המעגל שלה אל המעיין. בתי בתי קטן, היגיון של אגדה, היא מרגישה כמו ילדה קטנה בשדה גדול של הבנה דורה. פתאום שנדמה שהשחר לא יפציע לעולם, עוד עולה זיכרון ישן. פתאום שנדמה שהשחר לא יפציע לעולם, עוד עולה ומראה לאן. פתאום שנדמה שהשחר לא יפציע לעולם, עוד עולה זיכרון ישן. שהשחר לא יפציע לעולם.
A survey published by the nonprofit organization Tmunat Nitzachon, Image of Victory, has found that a significant majority of Israelis support Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's declared day-after plans for the post-Gaza war period, but there is significant skepticism in the public over the ability to realize the plan's civil and political goals. Tmunat Nitzachon co-founder Daniel Ben-Namer spoke to us about the survey findings and the mission of the organization.
Image of Victory was founded following the October 7th massacre and the war in Gaza, when we understood that Israel's goals were to eliminate Hamas, but not its ideology. Only the, you know, tunnels and weapon and terrorists. But we have to admit that Hamas is more than that. Hamas is an ideology. And if we refer to the days after World War II, we can use the term the denazification. And if we take it from there, we can use the word here, de-Hamasization, which is basically trying to eradicate Hamas ideology, and not to speak about the day after, but the generation after. It will take 20, 25 years, and we have to be ready.
So you're talking about change within the perspectives of the Palestinians, of the Gazans, and the ideology.
Yeah, of course, because we didn't choose this war. We didn't want it. But at the moment, in the moment that we were in, we understood and we understand now that there is no way to just, you know, eliminate Hamas organization. We need to change people's minds. And in order to do that, we need to re-educate and to change the textbooks and to change the narrative that they're learning and they're being taught in schools. And, you know, Israel is facing a very hard time now around the world when people speak about freeing Palestine from the river to the sea. And this is, like, you know, there was a very big movement about it in the world. And now we understand that it's Hamas ideology, basically. The thing is that they want us not here. They want the state of Israel to not be existed. And this is something that we should be aware of, and not just to think that if we will change Hamas in some militias or some, you know, other groups of people within the Gaza Strip that are not saying very clear and that they accept Israel and that they decide to finish the war, the 100 years war against the Zionism. So what did we do here?
So turning to the Israeli perspective, tell us a little bit about a survey you conducted on Israeli positions regarding the day after plan that's been presented by the prime minister for the post-war period.
Yes. So we wanted to know, after he launched his plan, we wanted to know how support does the plan get from the people in Israel. So we saw that 62% of the Israelis support the plan, which is basically a very high rate. We weren't expecting to see this number. And only 16% are opposing it. So after saying that, we must see that, however this number is very high, only 23% believe in Israel's ability to fully realize plan, the whole plan's objective. And I think that the gap is because of the Israeli people want a victory, and they want to win this war, and they want a definite win. But at the moment, when they see the government and the way they act, they are a bit suspicious, and they don't fully support it because they don't see them taking actions. So we know that we asked about the three categories or the three parts of the plan: the security objectives and the civic objectives and the political objectives. And we saw that only 23% of the Israeli people believe that it can be achieved. So this is interesting. I think that the message to the government is take action and make sure that not only the security plans are taking part, but also the political and the civil parts will happen. And for, you know, conclusion, I want to just mention a very important number that we saw in the poll. Most of the Israelis, 58% of the Israelis, want the Saudis and the UAE, the Emirates, to be involved in the Gaza Strip in the day after. So this is a very, I think, interesting number, because there is a need today, nowadays, to a consensus in the Israeli society. And I think that it shows when you divided into right voters and left voters or centric left voters, you can see that both in both sides there is a very dominant support. And I think it's a new, maybe it can be, if it will be used correctly, this is a new era of the Israeli discourse or the Israeli polarization.
Daniel Ben-Namer of Tmunat Nitzachon. Finally, Purim is observed tonight. As Israel commemorates the holiday amid the ongoing war, the Tzohar Rabbinical Organization, together with the Or Torah Stone Educational Network, is holding hundreds of community events, including local readings of the Megillah. In its 13th year, Megillah B'Kehillah includes readings in hotels hosting evacuees, as well as on IDF bases for soldiers located on the northern and southern fronts. A special reading is also taking place at Hostage Square in Tel Aviv, dedicated to the safe and immediate return of those in captivity in Gaza. We asked Rabbi David Stav, founder and chair of Tzohar and chief rabbi of Shoham, how to mark the holiday in these complex times.
As we all feel, we have mixed feelings. On one side, we cannot ignore the pain of tens of thousands of displaced families that were evacuated from the homes in the north and in the south. We cannot ignore the families of those who lost sons and daughters and fathers and parents and grandparents in the in the war in Gaza. We cannot ignore the pain of the hostages, the pain of the families of the hostages. We cannot ignore, and we shall not forget, the physical and mental pain of thousands of injured soldiers. And yet, we know that we have to change a bit the mindset when we arrive to the holiday of Purim, and we understand that despite of all the pain and despite of all the loss, we are happy for what we have, and we should be proud of what has been accomplished and what we achieved. And Purim is maybe the holiday that from one side symbolizes the rescue of the Jewish people, but not coming to a total peace solution. We don't sit under our dates and grapefruit. And in this situation of Purim, we are in the exile of Paras, in the exile under Haman, in the exile under those people who wanted to kill us. And once we were excused one time, it doesn't mean that the challenges have been have ended. And we know that throughout Jewish history, we will experience and will go through so many terrible events. And yet, we will always forget that we are here to stay. We are an eternal nation that will overcome all its enemies. And despite all the damages that we go through and the massacres that we had to go, through this year, we still exist. We defeat our enemies, and we still have a place and a space in our hearts to express our gratitude and our joy for the miracles that occurred to us then and keep on to occur to us every day.
So while these messages can be strengthening, what about the question of how should we celebrate the holiday day this year? Is there room to perhaps temper some of the traditional events, the parades that are held, how the general feeling? It's perhaps an example of the broader question of how does one go about life in light of the ongoing situation?
You know, I'm in my way now, in my way to mourn a family that this week we're told that they lost their son in October 7th in one of the battles there. And a few days after they discovered that the son was kidnapped, they thought he was kidnapped, the other son got married.
Yes.
And they consulted with me if to do the marriage. And I said, of course. I mean, and it's not only because of the very regular expression, life continues. It's much more than that. The fact that we are so sad for the fact that that boy is not with us, and that then they thought that he's kidnapped, does it cover, does it erase the joy that we feel with the second son that fell in love with a girl and they want to establish their life and they want to get married? There's no contradiction between the two. It's true that it's very hard to share the feelings and to divide them to different groups. But basically, we understand that there is a space in our hearts for joy, for the reasons we have to joy, if it's family, if it's community, if it's nation, grandchildren, etc., etc. And there is a space to be sad and to mourn for those who could not live with us now and could not share with us the same feeling. I think that despite whatever I said now, we should express sensitivity to a lot of families that are now mourning their civilians that are hostages, those who are injured, those who could not celebrate Purim in their homes. And we should show them and expose them to the fact that we understand them and we don't ignore that pain. So therefore, if the mayor of Jerusalem would consult with me, I would tell him not to not to make public parades in this time because of the pain that these families feel. But within closed doors, within the halls and the yeshivot and other places that celebrations will take place, I think people should feel happy for what has been accomplished, should express their sorrow about what has to be expressed. I could tell you that personally in my home, we will leave one chair without a present to represent and to as a symbol for those who could not celebrate today for whatever reason, if they are kidnapped or because of another reason. So to feel that the joy is not absolute and the joy is not 100%, and that we feel that it's the joy is mixed with mourning.
So let's speak a little bit about the project Megillah B'Kehillah, Megillah in the Community. It's in its 13th year. A bit about the events and also how they are also attuned to this sensitive time.
Well, first of all, more than 150 Megillah readings will take place in places that represent or symbolize the situation. More than 80 places or 90 places will be in places in the army bases that need our assistance, and in displaced communities that asked our involvement. In addition to hundreds of places that we read the Megillah every year in malls and other places, and today, this year, the demand is much higher than in previous years. So that's one thing. Maybe the most symbolic Megillah reading will be in the square of the hostages, in the place where the families to read the Megillah there. And you know, maybe some people don't realize that Esther, the Queen Esther, actually was the first Jewish girl that was kidnapped. She was not asked. She did not go to the king's palace because she wanted to marry, to fulfill a dream of a girl to get married to the king. She was taken to the king's palace. She was actually hostage in the king's palace. And we pray today in the time of Esther Festival, Esther Fast, and we will read the Megillah on the night of Purim in the hostages square to feel and to express that just like Esther was rescued and was saved then, we urge and we pray and we ask everybody who is capable to do whatever possible in order to bring the hostages back as soon as possible.
Rabbi David Stav, founder and chair of Tzohar. That concludes our program. Thanks for listening. You can find Khan English on the Khan Radio and digital platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and Spotify. This is Nomi Segal wishing you Shavua Tov. Here's Eti Ankri, Karata Li Estel. You called me Esther.
Karata Li Estel, Sheratziti Lishkoach, Vegiliti Simcha, Bamakom Sheratziti Livroach. קראת לי אסתר ואינך דממה שנינו למדנו באותה שממה אמרת לי אסתר